Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order, February 19th. We have two items on our agenda today, and given the absence so far of Representative Greenlick, we're going to take them in reverse order. So we're hoping Representative Greenlick will be on the way soon. And in the meantime, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2217. The folks who are here are already at the dais, so if you'd like to help us understand the bill after we hear a brief summary from Barbara, please.
HB 2217 amends statute defining subject individuals for purposes of criminal background checks for the departments within the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department to include the authority to conduct criminal records checks on persons applying for Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center jobs. Makes the amendments effective on the effective day of the act.
Thank you. If you could please start by identifying yourselves for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Van Landen, the Assistant Director for Administrative Services for Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And with me this afternoon, I have Sherry Frank, our Human Resource Manager from Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Chair Reed, members of the committee, we're here today asking for your support for House Bill 2217. This House Bill is a housekeeping measure. It provides authority to Oregon Parks and Recreation to conduct fingerprint criminal history checks on those positions for the Oregon State Fair that are now integrated into the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. House Bill 2517 of the 2005 legislative session established state agencies' authority to require fingerprint criminal history checks. The bill addressed Oregon State Fair Exposition Center in Section 8 and the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department in Section 55. House Bill 2157 became effective on August 17th of 2005, and shortly thereafter, on August 24th, House Bill 3502 abolished the Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center and integrated those duties into Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. However, it did not transfer those criteria for certain criminal history checks for some of those jobs that were transferred into Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. So essentially, this is giving us the authority to perform those criminal history checks in the three categories of whether they're a licensee, responsibility for sales or distribution of tickets, or access to buildings that may have private property belonging to the department or others, or friends groups or others. So we're respectfully requesting your support approving this bill, and it would revise Oregon's revised statute chapter 390, division 200, to include those three applicant categories documented in our testimony. And we thank you for your time hearing our testimony, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Frank, did you have anything to add, or?
No, I can answer any questions that you might have, Chairman, okay, and committee, in regards to the number of records checks that we do, or answer any technical questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Seems fairly fairly simple. You've done a nice job with the summary. So it's fair to say then that this is simply giving you the authority that exists elsewhere and consolidating. Is that right? Okay. Representative Holby?
How many record checks do you do?
Thank you.
She was waiting for someone.
Yeah.
Chairman and committee, we run about 3,000 criminal history checks a year.
Is that a fairly uniform sort of distribution? Is it pick up at various points in the year?
Actually, it's fairly high in regards, Chairman and the committee, in regards to our seasonal hiring of state fair temporaries, and then our volunteers and hosts in the parks.
And so the bulk is associated with, is there more associated with the fair than with other,
about
other equal responsibilities? Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. Well, seeing no other
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher?
I'm sure that they prepared some answers to questions they were expecting. So
good.
Are those answers to questions
we didn't
you were expecting?
Really a whole lot of questions other than how many do we conduct and what the purpose is of it. It's fairly straightforward, Bill. I mean, it's really truly just transferring that authority that isn't currently there.
You did kind of prompt us for that one question.
Yeah.
You got that one.
But
on,
thank
on
you
the
for helping.
Representative Holby?
So I guess one question leads to another. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm curious about the results of those criminal checks just overall and what you do with those criminal checks if it comes back that somebody has a criminal behavior. I'm assuming that you don't hire people that have certain kinds of criminal records. And so what's the purpose of the criminal record checks, and what triggers the not hiring somebody or not hiring them for services?
Let me answer that. Chairman and the committee, the individuals have an opportunity to disclose a criminal history, and failure to disclose is one of the ways that the agency may disqualify them. Others are types of felonies and the type of work that it is. We have a process where the applicant who has failed the criminal history check has a right to a contested case hearing, and they can protest the results of their criminal history check either through Oregon State Police, the FBI, or back through Oregon State Parks.
Thank you. Other questions?
Seeing no other questions, I think we can close the public hearing on House Bill 2217, unless there's anyone else who'd like to testify. Representative Berger, please come forward.
You better be nice.
She put her support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while we are waiting for Representative Greenlink, I thought I'd speak to the fact.
And if you wouldn't mind.
Representative Berger, Vicki Berger, House District 20, which is Salem area but does not encompass the actual Oregon State Fairgrounds. A few years ago, in times of crisis, we put the State Fair under the park system. It has been one of the best things that we could have done. Our fair is a valuable part of our state. The Parks has taken this on and done just a stellar job of keeping it part of their system but making it the unique exposition that it is. As it happens, as far as the bill itself, once when I chaired a committee, I had an entire session, I think Representative Galizio will remember, regarding fingerprinting and agency fingerprinting, and clearly the State Fair was one of those that most needed the authority because they do hire a lot of temporaries, and those temporaries work with children in a very complicated exposition setting. So I do support this bill, but mostly I just want you to know that the State Fair is going really great. It's in August. We should be out of here. Please come to the State Fair.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Was that prompt any other comments or questions from the committee?
Oh,
yeah,
Representative
no.
Holby?
Oh, no, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll pass.
Okay. With that, seeing no one else who's interested in being heard on House Bill 2217, we'll close the public hearing. Committee, shall we open a work session and move this bill? I'll open a work session on House Bill 2217. And Representative Galizio?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2217 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves House Bill 2217 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just concerned for my colleague, Representative Berger, that perhaps she doesn't have enough to do or needs more committee assignments. I just wanted to express it. Otherwise, I'm good with the bill.
Appreciate your concern, as I'm sure does Representative Berger. Perhaps you can have that conversation offline. Any other discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think in light of that comment, perhaps the carrier of the bill should be Representative Berger.
Second.
I don't think we require seconds on motions. But,
I was ready. I tried a third.
It's very good. It's very good. I'm wondering perhaps whether this might not make sense to go on the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, in honor of Representative Berger, I think it would make sense to put this on consent calendar.
Very good. And we'll see if she objects to that, given her presence in the room. Okay. Is there any objection to the bill going to the floor with the due pass recommendation being placed on the consent calendar? Seeing none, motion carries. House Bill 2217 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Please note a unanimous vote from our committee. And that closed the work session on House Bill 2217. This is perfect timing from Representative Greenlick, who's already here. We'll open and a public hearing on House Bill 2408 and invite the representatives forward. While they're coming forward, Barbara, if you could give us a summary of House Bill 2408, please.
House Bill 2408 creates the Task Force on Extending Washington County Commuter Rail to Salem, delineates the representation on the task force, and outlines a potential evaluation process to determine the viability of extending the current West Side Express service, West, to Salem-Keizer. Requires a report on their findings by October 1st, 2010. Directs the Legislative Administration Committee to provide staff support to the task force. Denies members of the task force reimbursement for out-of-pocket expenses. Directs all agencies of state government to assist the task force as needed. Sunsets the task force on the date of convening of the next regular biennial legislative session.
Thank you very much. I appreciate both of you being here, and if you can decide who would like to go first, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. At the beginning of this session, I had a wonderful staff member who's brand new to the legislative process, and a green bill back showed up in our office, and somebody was asking, did I want to be on the bill? And I looked at it, and it was this bill, and I said, oh, yes. And my staff dutifully typed my name up above as being chief sponsor, and I looked at it, and it said, uh-oh. I didn't mean to be chief sponsor and preempt the person who had handed me the bill. So I rushed to Representative Greenlick's office and said, well, there was this little error. And rather than white it out, what do you think? And he said, he'd love me to be chief sponsor. So that's how I got to be chief sponsor of this bill. But the truth is, I wholly support this bill. And I'm not wild about task forces, as you all know. But major transportation investments and major transportation future looks take time and they take study. Salem to Portland or South Portland or Vancouver is a major transportation corridor now. I drive it all the time. It is chock-a-block. You can't hardly get on the freeway at certain times. It makes sense if Wes is successful, and I believe it will be despite the train whistles, to start talking now about it, what it would look like to extend that kind of transportation corridor, and that's what this bill speaks to. But since I didn't design it, I will leave it to Representative Greenlick to bat cleanup here.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33 from the historic Tuolumne Valley, Tuolumne County in Tuolumne Valley, and I'm very, very happy to be here today, and I really appreciate, Mr. Chair, you hearing this bill. It's particularly apt to be having it in front of the Sustainability Committee, because if there's anything clear, this Willamette Valley corridor is not going to survive under the current form that as population increases, the ability to drive, to move freight, and to move people between Portland and Eugene and Eugene and Ashland is going to be significantly impaired. And that means we now need to be looking at alternatives to that. It took us about 17 years to get West from idea to reality, and I was very excited when I took the first ride on West on opening day. It was a smooth, delightful ride, a little noisy, blowing its horn all the time. But we can deal with that, I think. But it actually was wonderful, and as with all of the MAX lines, West exceeded its ridership estimates in the first week of service. When I first started talking about how West was going to happen in the 2003 session, it became clear that it was easier to extend the route, which is now from Beaverton to Wilsonville. It was easier to extend it from Wilsonville to Salem than it was in the in its original status. Original status, you had to buy some right-of-way, you had to improve things. The fact is, the right-of-way is there right now and readily available to extend that service from Wilsonville to Salem. Having said that it's there and it's available, it means it'll take us another 12 or 14 years to do it, because it gets very complicated. The federal government gets involved, and everybody knows how complicated that is, and you need close interaction between the state and local and federal people. But in 2003, as I began to talk to folks around, the Chariot folks here, the elected officials in Kaiser and in Salem, at first the notion was, gee, that's a weird idea. But by 2005, people began saying, oh, wait a minute, this is really feasible. And it was fed with such ideas as this. Wilsonville is going to be the place where industrial expansion is going to take place. They have the land and the access to the transportation options, and it's going to be a significant source of economic development. The folks in Kaiser said, gee, we could become a bedroom community for Wilsonville as a way of enhancing economic development of the Kaiser area if we had ready transportation between Kaiser and Wilsonville. And all of a sudden, the folks in Kaiser became very interested in the possibility of this happening. I've talked to the mayor and to other council people. Chariot became very interested because they were intrigued with the way TriMet had picked up and was managing WES to integrate it with its rapid transit system. So right now you can get on WES in Wilsonville, take it to the Beaverton Transit Mall, and pick up an airport MAX train at that same stop. And in one stop, you can end up going from Wilsonville to the airport in a way that if you really need to get to a plane, this might take 15 minutes longer than driving on a good day, but it's going to take a lot less than driving on a bad day to get from Wilsonville to the airport or from Tualatin to the airport. So all of a sudden, people began saying, yeah, it could go to Salem. In fact, recently I've heard, but wait a minute, you don't want to stop at Salem. You want to go to Eugene. And I think we could probably talk about that next, but one step at a time. All we're asking here, and we have ODOT's help, because ODOT is very much interested in it. It turns out TriMet's very anxious and talking about this. I met with the Chariot's development director on the train going from Tualatin to Wilsonville on opening day and talking about how interested Chariot was. I think the things are beginning to come into place. We're about to create a new 5-year Surface Transportation Act in Washington. We need to begin to get things in line to do that, and this next year is the ideal time to do that. So what we're asking is, we put in place a task force, we charge them with taking this seriously, beginning to task out how you can do ridership estimates and all this, get this on the plate so that the new surface transportation package can have some markers in it for this, and that we start considering something that can't happen for another 10 or 12 years. But I like to tell the story of Napoleon, who had this idea for how a road should look in the empire, and he had this idea of how the trees would be all over it, and he called his arborist then and said, here's what I'd like this road to look like. Can you get to work on it? And they said, well, but you realize it'll take 100 years to get it looking the way you want it to look. And he said, well, then start today. And it's, I mean, if this is something 12 and 14 years hence and it turns out to be a good idea, let's let it be 12 or 14 years from today and not 12 or 14 years from 2 years from now. That's where we are.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Greenleck and Representative Berger for bringing this forward. I fully support this concept, but you almost circumvented me there. But I'm curious. If I know there has been a little bit of talk about extending this task force to look at the entire Willamette Valley. I mean, Salem is a hub, and we have a tremendous amount of people that travel from here down south as well. And if if we're going to spend the energy and money on a task force, it seems like the bang for the buck would be to, especially since you're looking at a huge time frame for accomplishing these things, that, you know, we have great learning institutions in Eugene and Corvallis, and service to the southern end of the Willamette Valley seems like it would make an incredible amount of sense to include that in the study. I'm sure you must have reasons, so I'd like to hear whether you're for or against it, and hear why.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I mean, in addition to wanting to get a vote on the committee, I would certainly support an amendment that included that in the discussion. It gets a lot more complicated, but at least that ought to be off in the future. The serious question is, if we're looking off in the next 25 years, and I think that is what the new surface transportation system is, we need to find out how to have alternatives to I-5 all the way between Ashland and Portland. And there are serious questions about that. Part of it is, do we split Amtrak, you know, starts down and then cuts over to about Cottage Grove and goes to Klamath Falls? Do we figure out how to extend Amtrak service over time to there? Do we figure out how to use a commuter, which is heavy rail, to augment that kind of service? I mean, there are some very serious questions, but we absolutely need to be able to tie, I think, Ashland to Portland over the next couple of decades in a way that makes some sense by rail and perhaps by other options. But it is a complicated technical question. Do we double track Amtrak lines, which are expensive? What I do know is this has been picked as a corridor of interest for on the national scene, and we are going to be asking these questions. Certainly, you know, for any of us that have ever had a kid living in Portland and going to the University of Oregon, rapid rail transit would be just fantastic.
Representative Berger, did you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you would mind my response.
No,
Representative Holvey, I opened my remarks sincerely when I said I'm not wild about task forces. They tend to get mission creep and get bigger than, and so narrowing the scope of a task force is something that I think is important. That being said, I would certainly be welcome a friendly amendment that added something about this task force would be specific to Salem and connecting with Wes, but would be tasked with, you know, at least addressing, you know, future expansion as far south as Eugene. But I guess in my own way, not to lose a vote, or but task force to be effective to me need to have a very specific task and be at that task and be done. And I would certainly like them to look in this task force at possible future expansion of it as far as Eugene, if you wanted those words. So I wouldn't be averse to that kind of amendment. But I am sincere about task force getting kind of mission creep till they don't do anything. You understand my issue?
It does. Go ahead, Representative Hawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. I understand the thoughts of mission creep, but it just seemed like while you were doing a study on this, at least, you know, Eugene is a, you know, one of our larger cities in the state, and we do have a tremendous amount of travel that goes up and down this Willamette Valley, and I just think sustainable wise that it just seems to make sense if we're doing that study that I'm not saying that it should be the next step. I'm just saying that while we're doing the study, we should have that put in place so that, you know, that next step wouldn't take near as much time in the future. I just think it would be a wise investment if we're going to invest in that task force now. But anyway, I appreciate your comments.
That question prompts a little bit of a follow-up for me. If we sort of look back at the history of WES and some of the other efforts, does it make sense? Is there sort of a tiered approach in which you would be focusing particular emphasis on the next step and a little bit longer range on the next one? Is there a way to do that in an amendment?
Mr. Chair, the first thing I would suggest is perhaps we change Section 1A that talks about task force expanding the Washington County Commuter Rail south, and that would leave open the question of how far south, and I think it would be added by having a regional mean, adding, say, a regional person that could look further south than Salem, with the notion being, the first thing you have to know is it works from Beaverton to Wilsonville, and that's the first thing we have to find out. Then you look at the feasibility of moving it to the next step, and in fact, the easiest next step isn't quite into Salem. It's probably into North Salem with a shuttle while you extend from North Salem into downtown, which is a logical place for it, because of some track issues that are there. And then have on the agenda looking from Salem to the next stop, which would be wherever the Portland and Western line goes, but I think it's to Eugene, but it might also split off to Corvallis as well.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect we may have folks ready to testify that may be able to address this in more detail, but I thought I'd at least tee it up now. I'm just curious, dovetailing off the Chair's question, about the history of this. As the new person on the panel here, have we had task forces like this before? Is this an issue that's come up, and do we know how we've come to where we are today?
My trustee just handed me the the timeline, but it actually started in 1995 when Washington County met and talked about the creation. It's been sort of their dream for now, 14 years. And you had to do the preliminary things talk about, will there be sufficient ridership? Actually, some of these models are already being run now on the extension. Is there significant ridership? What are the barriers? Are there legal issues? Is there right of way? Those kind of questions. And after you do that, you can get into you can ask to get in line on the federal line, and you need to be in that line for a long time. That's why I'm talking about this time is particularly important, I think, on the federal side. And that was in 2000 that it was formally listed. In 2002, there was a federal set-aside of about $2 million to help really do some of the detailed work on that. And then in 2004, there was the final design approval. So, I mean, this is a serious stepwise issue. We started supporting it here when we created the Choo Choo Caucus in the 2003 session, which I haven't called yet for this session, but which is called to order with the blowing of the train whistle. And we were particularly interested with the saving of the Cascade trains between Eugene and Portland and then on to Seattle. And we actually came up with a bill in the 2007 session that provided a source of funds for most of that train. So we were working on this stuff. The construction started in 2006. They had a little problem with the train sets were subject to the Buy America restriction, so they were working with the only American company at the time who could produce the self-moving trains, self-propelled train sets, because they had to meet heavy rail is very different than light rail, and they have to meet a different kind of crash standards. They finally struggled through that in 2007 into 2008 and ended up starting in October of 2009. So basically it took 14 years from the time we first started talking about it in a serious way. It was about the time Max got to Beaverton.
Other questions? Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, we can't go to Ontario.
You know, I was just going to ask. I was just going to ask if that was a corridor of interest.
Well, actually, the truth of the matter is the East-West corridor is a corridor of interest, and we have the Empire Builder that goes east, but it goes east in a particular way. It goes north and then further. We had train service as recently as 8 or 9 years ago, I think, that did go east, and I think to Boise, to that route to get to Chicago. And I think that's a very important route. And I know Senator Wyden is very interested in trying to revive interest in that route that would go from Portland a little bit south as it goes east rather than going north. It's not going to be a commuter line, I think, because That's not going to work, but I absolutely believe we're going to need to move rail service in that direction. You join the Chichu Caucus, and we can start working on that.
Representative Vince. I think also being new to these discussions about transportation, the issue of greatest interest to me is the decision to allocate the huge amounts of money to this device, maybe at the cost of other types of transportation alternatives for other parts of the state. And it would be of great interest to me to see how the task force manages that element of the debate, because as we move down the valley, fewer folks are going to be commuting as opposed to that, I hope, which is now happening in Portland, and that's justifying that expense that we've already made. And I ride that all the time. I really enjoy that arrangement to get from the airport to downtown Portland, and I hope someday to be right here. It sure does reflect an enormous investment, and one that reminds me of the remarks that Gail Ackerman made some time ago before this committee, a couple of 3 weeks, about the issue of sustainability. And as you make the Willamette Valley more and more and more attractive, you actually are maybe making it less sustainable. Now, I would hope, again, that these kind of issues will be addressed, and I'm sure they will be. So I look forward to the task force. I was going to ask if you buy my vote in some fashion, but I realized...
Give you a free pass to Salem? I'll be glad to issue that for you.
Chair, I will see that they all get a ride down the west to the Oregon State Fair in August.
Do we have to have our fingerprints checked, though?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, there is a serious question raised, and the fact is, a very small proportion of the transportation dollars are spent on rail alternatives, both at the federal level and in the state level. In the state, of course, the gas tax is constitutionally dedicated to highways, and the funds to support rail have to come from a different source. And for example, oddly, the funds to support the Cascade train came from dedication of the funds of the profits for vanity license plates, under the assumption that it didn't have to be dedicated to roads and it could be a way to have some alternatives. The major question at the federal level in this Surface Transportation Act, which is being debated now and is expected to probably take another year and a half, is the multimodal process for moving freight. We're talking here about not only moving passengers, we're talking about making way for the expeditious movement of freight, which is a very important piece. And if there are cars on the road in front of the trucks, it makes the trucks very hard to deal with. So we're talking about multimodal models, and we're also talking about pure passenger rail in that debate. But it's a tiny part of the transportation budget.
Mr. Chair, may I be excused?
Of course.
I just realized I have 7 doctors waiting for me.
Thank you for being here, Representative.
I'm happy to stay here as long as you want, because my alternative is to go to Ways and Means and listen to the cuts in human services. It feels much more.
We'll see if we can generate any more questions for you, Representative Holby.
I just have one more little item, Mr. Chair, before Representative Greenland gets away. Just in seriousness and discussion of the southern end of the Willamette Valley, I know that I noticed that one of your task force members is a representative of the 5th Congressional District. I know that the 4th Congressional District also, would have a great interest and also has a lot of influence in
more
the
power,
transportation arena at the congressional or national level. So anyway, just a little note to think about.
Include that in the amendment.
Other questions? We have a number of people who have signed up to testify.
No.
We're happy to have you stick around.
No,
But
I need to go watch the bloodshed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For hearing the bill and for putting up with me.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So I think it would make sense next to call the chair of the Clackamas County Commission. Lynn Peterson is here. We appreciate hearing from her.
Good afternoon. Chair Reed and members of the committee, I'm just down here to completely throw my support and the commission's support behind this concept.
And if you would,
Lynn Peterson, Clackamas County Chair. Also, just to point out 2 things. One, as we move forward, the Washington County portion of this has been built. It does end in Clackamas County West, and so it is actually called the West Side Express Service, so we kind of need to keep that going, because if this were to come down to Salem, we'd go through several other counties, and it does end again in Clackamas County today. So we're actually asking for the second part of this is the, I think that there was an amendment by Representative Greenlake to add Clackamas County as a representative to the task force, because it is such an important part of our regional issues, and we are trying with all our hearts to protect the capacity that we do have in I-5 through Wilsonville, and it is pretty important for us to see this through. So if you could put us on, that would be great.
Appreciate that.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, and appreciate that you noted there is a Dash 1 amendment that does what you described. I think we're also uncovering potential for some other amendments, too. So
yeah.
I appreciate your noting that. Any questions for the Chair? I think you've done a good job.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for everything.
Representative Bailey?
Oh.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, just for the record, note that of the committees at least I'm on, I think this is the fourth time I've seen Chair Peterson come down and testify in front of the committee, and I just wanted to honor her for really doing a service to her constituents to come down here to the legislature and advocate for their issues.
Well, thank you. We've got a great lobbyist, too, who alerts me when everything we're interested in is coming forward, so I appreciate that as well, but thank you. And while I have a moment, can I just go back to the all the way south to Ashland someday, that issue? I think what we really need to keep in mind is that no matter what mode you're talking about, transportation dollars are limited, and they need to be extremely focused. And right now we're in a mode where we really need to, when we're working with FTA, look at the cost effectiveness as a big measure, and the amount of money that you put in, the ridership that you get out. If we take very specific steps and show success along the way, it makes every next step even that much more successful. So we have to be very careful about how we do that, and I think that there are other options that we should be looking at in order to get better service, and I fully support having the task force look at those other options to continue to have service to those other areas and increase the service in some way during that time period that you're ramping up the northern portion. So just think about it that way.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for being here. Call up the next panel. We'll try to do three people at one time, so we have three chairs. Stephen Dickey, Olivia Clark, and Greg Leo, please.
Please,
you can decide who goes first.
All right. My name is Chair Reed, members of the committee. Thank you for this time. My name is Steve Dickey. I'm the Director of Transportation Development for Chariot, Salem-Kaiser Transit. And our interest in coming to this is somewhat based on my background. I spent 4 years as the Director of Transit in the city of Wilsonville, operating the SMART system. And during that four-year period, was deeply involved with developing and working with the development of WES, which is now currently operating, and we're glad to see that. A lot of work went into place to get that to happen, and we're very satisfied to see that it's up and running now. It was a very successful multi-jurisdictional effort. There were 5 cities, 2 counties, 2 transit systems, a railroad, and state and federal agencies that worked together to make this happen. Especially at the station in Wilsonville, there were several parties involved with developing that station so it would be successful and useful for the region. But now my role at Chariots, we have an interest also as we view ourselves not just as a local transit system, but also as a regional partner. We have oversight not only of our own system, but we also over the CART system, which operates in the rural parts of Marion and Polk counties. And we have a good working relationship with SMART, where we share one of the routes that travels between Salem and Wilsonville. One of the primary benefits that we saw when I was with Wilsonville was that the West would create opportunities for people to access employment. And as already been mentioned, Wilsonville is a primary employment center. There are also significant employment opportunities here in the state's capital. And by opening up transportation options for folks, it really creates an opportunity not only for employees to access employment, but also for employers to draw from a much larger base of potential employees to come and work as a qualified workforce for their organizations. It's also something that we need to look at is the aspect of traffic reduction. In my 4 years, I continued to live in Salem and commuted to Wilsonville. And over that four-year period, I continued to watch the traffic south of Wilsonville grow and the congestion grow to a point where backups on the freeway that normally were more consistent with areas further north were happening south of Wilsonville. And often we would see that backup clear down to the Aurora Donald exit, which is much further south than we had traditionally seen. It really was indicative of the increase in commuter traffic that is happening between the two metropolitan areas. The other aspect that we look at is that there's an ever-decreasing sense of separation between the Salem-Kaiser metropolitan area and the Portland metropolitan area. It's really never a second thought for many people now to think of taking a job in one of those other areas and making that commute on a daily basis, or just getting in their car and traveling to one of the adjacent areas to go for dinner or to go shopping. It really has become just a common area that people are willing to travel. And because of that, we see a significant increase in the demands on our road system, and that opportunity for people to have an alternative really will alleviate some of that the demand on the system. When you look at the transportation modeling done by Metro and some of the other metropolitan planning organizations, there's a concept called a super region that they anticipate will be a designation over the next decade or two, which includes the Salem-Kaiser area and the Portland metropolitan area. And actually the boundaries drawn by this are just north of Vancouver and just south of Salem. And the primary data that generates this picture is the commute patterns and the flow of traffic in and between these areas and the volume of traffic that travels through there. When you look at the maps that are done in this modeling, there really is no distinction between the two. It is a steady flow of traffic in both directions. And this is a problem that we are going to have to address. The formation of this task force and the reason we're supportive of it is that we need to step back and take the time to objectively identify the need and the growing support that actually does not happen overnight. Representative Greenlick is correct. It takes time. It takes time for these things to happen. It takes time to get them right. But if we wait to begin the process, we're further behind. The growing motivators for us to do something about this aren't waiting for us. The growth in traffic congestion that I witnessed over just a four-year period continues to grow. And as our state continues to be a very popular location for people to come and live, that demand on our system will continue to increase as well. Opportunity, I see by the proposed list of partners in this, presents a very strong opportunity for partnerships. I think it's a well-represented list, and I think that it is something that we would like to see move forward so that we can take the proper steps to prepare for something that I think would be very beneficial to our area. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go first, then we can take questions for the
Greg Leo with the City of Wilsonville. Chairman Reed, members of the committee. The City of Wilsonville strongly supports House Bill 2408. Our experience with West has been excellent. Ridership is up. We think it's a great opportunity. We've had an opportunity also to meet monthly with the French Prairie Forum, which is a informal discussion group of governments in the northern Marion County area. We've talked about this legislation, and we've also talked about opportunities for coordinating rural public transportation between the cities of Canby, Woodburn, Aurora, Donald. And yes, Little Donald is in here. The train tracks run right through Donald, and so it's important that Donald has a place at the table, I think. This is a good step forward. It's a great way to coordinate the activity here, to look at the real issues confronting rail service in the Willamette Valley, and I urge your support today of House Bill 2408.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Clark.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Olivia Clark, the Director of Government Affairs at TriMet, and I think you've almost heard everything. I don't want to be repetitious. I'm really here to answer any questions that you might have. I think this bill is a very good idea because it is, in fact, a long-term effort. It takes a long-term commitment to make these kinds of projects go. It takes a lot of dedication and, I would say, intestinal fortitude to get through everything that you have to get through to make this kind of thing work. And I think Representative Greenlich and Representative Berger did a great job overviewing some of that, the history. I can certainly provide more detail, but I have a couple of handouts that have some of the history, some of the timelines, the milestones that we had to go through. Because it was a partnership with the federal government, it made it also a longer-term project and a little more difficult. And because we don't have a lot of experience in working with FRA, that was a whole new ball of wax, a whole new set of regulations that we have to deal with. This is not like light rail. This is a heavy rail. It's a different kind of animal with all different kinds of regulations. But I think it's definitely worthwhile. It is an experiment. It's the first of its kind in Oregon, although it's commonly found in other parts of the country. This is the first time we've done that, and it's an experiment in sharing the rail. I think one thing that we really haven't talked about is sharing the rail with the private sector, with the freight line, and perhaps Kelly Taylor from the rail division will talk a little bit about that. But that also is an interesting partnership, and it continues to evolve. So with that, I would just be happy to answer any questions. I think it's a good bill, and we're happy to participate.
Thank you. Representative Galizio.
Yes. Ms. Clark, and this is a little dangerous, and I hope this was not covered while I was not here, and I don't think it was, but would this, well, what impact, if any, would this have on the larger picture looking at Barber Boulevard?
Mm. Oh, I already covered that.
not Barber Boulevard in Silverton.
You know, that we've talked about. Would this have... What impact, if any, would this have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, that's a good question. I hadn't really thought about that. Because the Barber Boulevard light rail proposal that's beginning to get some play is really within the TriMet region. This is going way outside of the TriMet region. So actually, I think the good thing about this bill is that you're going to be able to deal with questions of governance, of ownership, of shared use. That I don't think it interferes with our work to continue to work on the TriMet system as a whole.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is quite a day for me in transportation. Today on the floor, the representative known as the soul of Portland, I think we all know who I'm talking about, actually said he was actually looking out for rural Oregon on a bill that normally would help commuters in Portland. That to me was just moving. And now it's announced that you're coming finally to my district, which I'm grateful for. I see you mentioned it's coming through Donald.
Yes.
And while I have no idea why anyone would want to go to Skinner's Mud Hole, I have to agree with my colleague that the numbers are there, looking very perplexed. That's Eugene. So.
Oh.
But the best point that he made, and he makes many, is federal dollars, mm-hmm. and looking at this strategically, which would bode well for that district. In my way of looking at this, the reason we have such a strong and healthy commuter system or infrastructure in Portland is because of the Hatfield, Acoin, Packwood, Goldschmidt days. Mm-hmm. Having said that, everybody's on board here, pardon the pun, to go the next step, Wilsonville Salem. What about the other way? I mean, if you're going to look at numbers, and I don't think that numbers alone should dictate this, we should let industry to some extent dictate this. That's another point for our task force. But what about the other way? How have we come... Representative Greenlich said a lot about this, but how have we come to the conclusion that, in fact, this task force should focus on Wilsonville to Salem? Because I'd love for it to come to Silverton. That's not going to happen. But there's another east-west corridor that our county commissioner's gone that might be a priority. How do you arrive at that and say this is where the task force needs to focus?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, let me take a stab at a couple of those questions. First of all, I'd like to go back to the largesse of the metropolitan area, and I would like to know who the soul of Portland is, too. I'm not sure I know which member that is.
Representative Shields.
Oh, okay.
His own moniker.
I will make a note of that. back to our success as a region in terms of alternative transportation and transit in particular is that you're correct. We had members of Congress and still have members of Congress statewide, not just the metropolitan region, who were very supportive and have been very well positioned to assist. But since that time, as our delegation has changed, we also have a model that's been very successful that the rest of the country is trying to replicate, and that's the integration of our land use planning and transportation in the metropolitan area. I wouldn't want you to think that this is just, you know, earmarking and getting money. It's actually really good projects that produce tremendous ridership. In fact, the TriMet region has the seventh highest per capita ridership in the United States, which is about the integration of where you have development and where you put your transportation dollar. So I just wanted to add that little commercial there. The second question you had was why this particular alignment. And I wanted to make the point that I think that this bill actually complements the work that Kelly Taylor is doing in the rail division to look at the big picture. Where are the rail lines across the state, active, abandoned, potential, to really look at that and what we should be doing. So this is a complement. And actually, the line that we're talking about right now, probably in Oregon, is where the greatest number of passengers may come from. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking to Columbia County, Clatsop County. There are short line railroads all over the state that have the potential to have a partnership. And I don't know, Representative Gilliam, if you were talking about the Columbia River Crossing as well, and that's a whole different animal going to another metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking mainly of the Sunrise Corridor.
Other questions?
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, as we go forward here, and we're looking at a task force, and obviously this will be a subject for the task force, but what are some of the key pitfalls that are out there and looking at this that might derail the project?
I would just offer, of course, always funding. And in this case, inertia. I mean, we had this bill here last session. We pushed it. I think we did a lot of good work with the amendment to include some of the smaller communities. So one big problem is just getting it through the legislative process, getting the task force established, and then starting to put some cost numbers on what a real operational entity might look like. That's what I would offer, Representative Bailey.
I appreciate that that comment. Of course,
thank you.
Representative Greenlick left us to go deal with some of the same issues in another context. So that's something to keep in mind for all of us, the costs associated with this, even with the task force itself.
That's right.
Please, you had a comment too?
Chair Reed, Representative Bailey, the other thing, and this is something that we encountered in a small way, is that because you have multi-jurisdictional involvement, anytime you go outside of a single district, then the negotiations and the oversight of any system has to be something that is worked through in that process of who operates it, who has oversight of it, who has the responsibility for the funding control. And those are things, though, that getting the partners on board early and involved early is critical for that to be a successful proposition.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to add that because this has only been in operation 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever this is, we have yet to know exactly what all the pitfalls are. I think we need some experience here to see how this is going to work in a shared use arrangement with the private rail. But all those issues of governance, operations, and where we're going to find the vehicles is another question.
Maybe I could build a little on that question and change it slightly. And if I don't go too far enough away from what you'd already answered, please feel free to say that your previous answer covers it. What have you learned just from the task force portion that causes you to think this is the right approach, or are there things that need to be different in this than the West experience?
Chairman Reed, I'd just like to say that a lot of thought has gone into who would be at the table in this particular segment, and I think it is a phased process. And I am just very pleased that the cities of Woodburn and Donald and the local communities that can access the rail line are actually involved in the process. That's, I think, one of the successes so far.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the keys will be having TriMet come in and provide information on its experience. We are required under federal law to do a before and after study 1 year later. That kind of information should be presented to this group. Those lessons will be revealed.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to try this angle again, and I'm not articulating it very well, and that surprises no one. When you do this modeling, which I don't know much about, which I'd be interested in learning about, it seems to me, it sounds like it's in response to data that you have. I mean, obviously, you want to improve employment opportunities in areas where there's great potential. Wilsonville's proven that. Salem's just seems to make sense to connect them and make everybody's job opportunities go up. But when you're modeling and when you're doing task forces on transportation, if they, as they appear to me to be, all government folk, all good people, my mayor of Donald, I'm, again, glad he'll be on this task force if this is the way it passes. But what about private enterprise? What about industry? What about those in the other half of our moniker and our committee, economic development? To what extent do they drive this instead of us just reacting, well, we've grown over here, therefore we need more transportation? I understand that. But strategically, how do we let in now in transportation the people that we hope are creating jobs, that not we're not just reacting? Does that make any sense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilman, I think that's a really, really good question for the overall transportation system, not just for this particular project. And I think those issues are taken into consideration by the folks that do the modeling, which are at Metro. We actually don't do the modeling. The MPOs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, do the modeling and take those things into consideration. Just as a little story, one of the struggles that we had on this particular package going to the federal government is on the modeling, and that the federal government would not allow us to look beyond the TriMet region for where the ridership would come from, and actually penalized us for that. They also had their own opinions about where people were going, despite what we told them. And I think after some experience, we'll be able to go back and say, we were actually right. People are coming in from all over the south part of the state to get to the region. In fact, people get on in Wilsonville, and they wouldn't recognize that people might be going to downtown Portland. They wouldn't allow us to project that kind of ridership. So we have our own struggle with the federal modelers as well. But I think your question is a terrific one, really, for all of our transportation planning and investments.
Other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Patrick.
You were talking about timing issues, and that it is a rather young system right now, the West Side Express Service. Does the deadline that's put forth in this particular bill give you enough time, in your opinion, to make good assumptions? I think it's a report back to the legislature October 2010. Does that give you enough time to have good information to come forth with a good report?
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, the longest journey begins with the first step, and I think with the information at hand, there can be some good work done by the task force. Can it be conclusive? Well, no. The more time you have, the better, excuse the pun, track record you have to work with. But I think for the time being, there is adequate information to do the preliminary work that could make this a valuable task force process.
Please.
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, I concur with Mr. Leo that as we go through this process, we will have data that will continue to accumulate, but we also have some data in place as it is with just representing current data, including our Route 1X bus service that runs between Wilsonville and Salem at this time, just the success of that route. 9 round trips a day previous to West opening, we're generating about 100,000 trips a year. Now, compared to a local service, that may not be a very high number, but when you consider it's only 9 round trips a day that operates only during peak commute service on days Monday through Friday, then that's a fairly significant number of rides. And some of those trips are constrained by the capacity of a 40-foot bus. We're running 40-foot buses that have seating capacity for about 40 people, and they're running anywhere from 55 to 60 people on those buses. So there is a demand for an alternative to driving, and some of the limit of that growing beyond that is just the capacity.
are just cramming those people, more people than there are seats, or people standing? Or?
There are people standing at 65 miles an hour going down the freeway.
Mr. Chair, follow up. You mentioned success and number of trips in the same kind of. So I'm wondering, how is, do you define success by the number of trips that the train takes, or by the number of people actually being carried?
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, that success rates are typically measured by number of trips, but also by your what level of capacity that you're filling. In other words, you could always overload a route with capacity, lots more buses, and then the buses are half full. That's not measured as a success because you're not utilizing your resources. But on the other hand, if you constrain your growth and constrain your capacity by not putting enough resources out there, then it also is not being as successful as it could be. What we see by the ridership that we see on that route is that there is a demand for more service, and we regularly get that communication from the public as well. Please put more buses out there. Please add service, because they show up, and there are times when people just simply won't get on the bus because it's already packed full and they don't want to ride in a standing position for that length of time.
I had one more question for the group, and I guess primarily for Ms. Clark. You mentioned something about the cars themselves, and so I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that experience, and particularly to build on Representative Gilliam's point about the economic development potential. I know just enough to know that that was an issue in finding the appropriate equipment and so on, so guaranteeing or at least signaling that we'd be interested in further development of this sort of system, does that create more demand? Are there likely to be economic development potential from that sort of an effect?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that question. It was a difficult relationship with the manufacturer, the Colorado Rail Car, for a variety of reasons, and we're very pleased to have the cars now, to have the cars that we have. We did have a backup plan should that fail, and we were talking to Oregon Ironworks. There is definitely a need to expand that industry in the United States. Because this was a federally funded project, or partially federally funded, we had to abide by Buy America. And what that meant was, when we put the RFP out, we really only had two responses, and only one of them was serious, and that was the Colorado Rail Car, and it was the only one that had a crash-worthy vehicle, aside from being American-made, in addition to that. They had been providing or building very good rail cars for Alaska for quite a while. We had heard they were having financial difficulties, and we did a lot of risk management, and it got to the point where we were actually sending people to the plant to watch what they were doing, to making sure that they were purchasing supplies for the trains they were building for us. But we did have a backup plan should they have failed, and that was to go to Oregon Ironworks. We had set that up. But I do think in the future, if we are talking expansion in Oregon or anywhere else in the United States that wants this kind of a self-propelled vehicle, that we're going to need to find other manufacturers, and Oregon Ironworks would be a great place to do that.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions? Appreciate you being here. Thanks for your testimony. Next on our list, I call up Fred Nussbaum and John Charles, please. Mr. Charles, if you'd like to start, happy to hear from you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a market-oriented research center in Portland, and I agree that transit service from Wilsonville to Salem is desirable, but as a previous witness has pointed out, we already have express bus service from Wilsonville to Salem. The Route 1X is operated jointly by SMART and Chariots. It's an extremely modest price, $2.50 per trip retail, or if you buy a monthly pass, you work it down to about $1.25 per one-way trip. The service is well used, as he said. It's crowded. They probably should expand. And the marginal cost of expanding to buy pretty clean burning buses is probably in the order of $321,000, according to FTA, or at least as of a year and a half ago. Could be a little higher now or lower. SMART estimates that the additional operating cost for one more run is $70,000, starting in 2009. And since all the buses use the existing roadway infrastructure, the ubiquitous roadway system, there's no other capital cost. Well, in comparison, the recently opened West incurred capital costs of roughly $166 million, I'm not sure the final accounting is in, for a 14.7-mile trip, or $11.3 million per mile, and the rail vehicles cost over $6 million per vehicle. So each one-way trip from Wilsonville to Salem is about 31 miles. So the total capital cost of adding to servicing 80 more bus passengers, which is what a train car takes, would be the cost of maybe two buses or maybe $680,000. For rail, assuming you have freight tracks and can negotiate the labyrinth of things you'd have to do to actually make it work, the capital cost might be $350 million a decade later. So in other words, the incremental cost of another couple buses is maybe 0.2 or 3% of the train. Moreover, the commuter rail is not really offering any operational advantages that I know of. You know, at least with light rail, if you have two cars and you have one person up front, and you have a lot of customers, you have some economies of scale. But for the West, for most of the cars, you have a person up front plus a conductor in the back, plus if there's another car behind it, you have another conductor there. And you only have 74 seats for most of the cars, 80 for one of them. So you're not really saving operationally compared to a bus, which is going to have one bus driver. Moreover, buses are a lot more flexible. Service can be added and dropped. Routes can be changed. Right now, West is limited to peak hour service because they share the track. If you had actually had a whole bunch of consumer demand for that, you'd have a hard time increasing the use. Also, of course, commuter rail is only moving people. It's not moving freight. Commerce. A roadway is open 24/7, moving commerce, people, emergency service vehicles, everything. Now, in my effort to provide you with high-quality research, Mr. Chairman, I did, in fact, park at the in one of the Tiger stops this morning and took the 629 West down to Wilsonville, and which I hadn't been on before. It's a great ride, certainly way better than light rail. It's going to be hard for me to get on light rail anymore now that I've experienced seats built for real adults instead of people with 24-inch waists or something. And onboard Wi-Fi is great. Not very many people on the train, so I had lots of places to spread out. And then I get off of Wilsonville. I walk about 50 yards. I hop on a 91 Express, which is also pretty nice seats, and get on the freeway and zoom all the way down to the Capitol and get dropped off right here at the front door. That's great. I actually have not done that exact commute because the West has only been open for a few weeks, but I'm thinking I might have to get some monthly passes now and start doing it that way. The cost to me was almost nothing compared to what my employer would reimburse. I probably saved my employer $40 doing that. Of course, it's all subsidized. I mean, thanks to taxpayers, I saved a lot of money. But so I'm just saying, as a transit customer, I'm saying, what problem are you trying to solve with this bill? You can hardly get more convenient than getting off of West, walking, getting on the bus, zooming down I-5 at 65 miles an hour, and getting dropped off right at the front door here, which the train will never do, because trains don't use the ubiquitous road system. They only go to a few select places. So if you get dropped off the train 500, 600,000 yards from this building, a whole bunch of customers will be made worse off if you cannibalized the existing bus service with train service. Final point I guess I'll make is that any estimate of ridership and capital cost for the Salem train would suffer all the flaws that we had with the West. And on page 2 of my testimony, I indicate, going back to 1997, chronologically forward, you could have had just thrown darts at boards to come up with some of the estimates of cost and ridership. They were all over the map from FTA, from Congressman Wu, from TriMet. And then we actually did counts last Wednesday. After all the tourists left the first week, we put people at every single stop, every single train, morning and afternoon, and the actual number of riders for last Wednesday were 1,150, far below estimates. And this is normal in this kind of work, which is estimates of ridership proved to be overstated, estimates of capital costs proved to be vastly understated. So this is real money. Someone has to pay. And whether it's bus or transit, these are huge money pits. So it seems like you should try and limit the bleeding here by just using the existing roadway service or system. And if you want slightly better service from Wilsonville to Salem, take what you already have. And the money you save from not doing rail, you could buy the fanciest buses in the history of humanity, go down to Eugene and buy a bunch of RVs and trek them out like rock stars do and run them up and down from Wilsonville to Salem, free coffee, free Wi-Fi, the whole thing. You still save tons of money compared to rail. So I think that's the way to go. And now, notwithstanding my compelling testimony, I know that there is a slight chance you might move this bill. So I'd just like to point out that if you do, I'd suggest in Section 2, you amend that so that the word shall on page 1, line 31, and may on page 2, line 5, be transposed. It seems more logical to require that the need for rail be identified and analyzed prior to mandating the public relations campaign that promotes it. Thank you.
Thank you. I had two quick questions on your testimony, make sure I understand it correctly. On the first page, you talked about the cost for operating one run would be $70,000 annually. Do you mean by that one bus operating on the same schedule for a year?
Is that what you're saying? I infer adding, well, they have nine, as the previous witness said, they have nine trips. So if you want a tenth.
Okay, so one more bus running on the same schedule for a year. I just want to make sure I understand.
I believe that's what they mean. It's from their website.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And then OTI as a source on your second page?
Oregon Transportation Institute. It's just another citizens group like ours. Okay. We rounded up out of volunteers between us to do the early morning counts and afternoon counts.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Nussbaum, then we can perhaps have some questions for you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Fred Nussbaum. I'm the strategic planner for the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates. We've been around since 1976, and many of our members have been active in the field of transportation, including myself. I've been involved in as a service planner at TriMet. I've been a modeler at Metro. So we know a little bit about transportation. I won't repeat what's in my written testimony, which you should have before you, because I think you've also heard a lot of the reasons why my organization supports this bill. We do have some amendments that we'd like to, one amendment that would add some representation for consumer advocates on this task force, and I'll get to the specifics of that in a moment. What I really like to do is answer some of the questions that I heard the committee pose to some of the other witnesses. First of all, the question of why shouldn't the task force look at extension to Eugene as part of its mission? And one of the things that we need to remember is that transit comes in many different flavors. WES and commuter rail service that we're talking about extending here is still a transit type of service. There's no toilets on the train. There's no food service on the train. So when you start getting into distances of more than 50 miles, that can be a problem. Amtrak service, Cascade service, do have those facilities, do have food, do have toilets, and so on. So you can travel longer distances more conveniently. That's one point. The other point is that, and I think one of the witnesses alluded to, is that the state rail division is or should be doing a comprehensive rail study, passenger rail study for the entire state. We had one study back in 1992, which is an example of a task force that had representation from many different areas, by the way. That needs to be updated to current realities. So maybe this one task force shouldn't be doing all those jobs at once and maybe focus on extension of WES. Why extension of WES? Because we already have something operating in that corridor. It's the same tracks that continue on that are operated by the same railroad, the same short line railroad. So there are a number of things that you can build upon using West technology and the West approach between Wilsonville and Salem. Let's see. There was a question about task forces and whether they've been used before in this kind of a thing. I mentioned the 1992 Willamette Valley passenger rail, the Rail Passenger Policy and Plan Advisory Committee. That's what helped get our additional Amtrak service between Portland and Eugene. There was an earlier passenger task force back related to the 1980-81 experiment in Willamette Valley. There was a task force that was involved in that. Finally, as an adjunct, maybe not in the planning, but in the review and advising on adding additional service in Willamette Valley, we had for a while the Willamette Valley Passenger Rail Advisory Council, which had representatives from local jurisdictions, consumer advocates, also private enterprise, shippers, and so on. And that committee lasted for, I believe, 8 years. That later was changed to the Oregon Passenger Rail Advisory Council. But it had many of the same functions as this task force, except it was statewide, mainly focusing on the Willamette Valley Cascade Service. I think Representative Bailey asked what some of the pitfalls might be for a task force of this nature. My reply to that is thinking too small. AORTA, my group, was instrumental in getting the ball rolling on commuter rail in the Portland area. Before we started talking about commuter rail back in the 1994-95, light rail was the only flavor of transit that was being looked at in the Portland area. We got the ball rolling, and then Washington County took off with that with their own task force culminating in West as we see it today. AORTA had gone up to Vancouver, B.C. to see their successful commuter rail line, West Coast Express. They were able to build that line in 18 months from the time that they decided they were going to do that. Now, of course, it's a different government, a whole different country, but it is possible other places in the United States have been able to do better than 18 years. Now, I'm not blaming anybody for that here in our area, but that's the 18 years is not necessary. Seattle got their sounder service running a little faster than we did here.
Mr. Nussbaum, maybe I could just ask if you're about ready to wrap up. I'm mindful of the time, and I know we have one more person we want to hear from and give you all a chance to respond to questions of the committee, too.
Basically, all I wanted to add in there, then, is the amendments that we would like to make is to add two representatives to this task force. One would be from people that are involved in the Public Transit Advisory Committee dealing with small area transit. You have on this bill right now, you've got the Salem Transit and you've got TriMet represented. What you don't have are smaller people that use the service in smaller communities or people that operate the service. So that's one additional member. The second one is to have a consumer advocate on the task force for a number of reasons. These, the consumer advocate would represent people that would actually use the service, would be able to help determine what's important, what isn't. Many consumer advocates also have some knowledge and experience with other similar service, either in this country or around the world.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Perhaps Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, thanks. John, I was looking at the numbers on the back of your letter, and you have listed the costs as, I guess, estimated, based on estimated ridership per day. What's the cost number you're using? I'm just trying to figure out your equation. I just want to be clear.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you trying to ask me how I calculated the cost of expansion to Salem? Or
yeah. Is this the cost per
or maybe just
day?
If I could jump in, you could just walk us through this chart on the back of
perhaps.
This testimony.
Perhaps.
On the back.
Tell us what the cost per those, the cost per day.
Those were just I started keeping a file on this subject from 1996 on, and it was interesting to me that the estimated ridership and the estimated cost of construction kept changing over and over. All these different sources, and you know, at one point the feds were not going to fund it at all because the ridership was going to be too low until Senator Gordon Smith earmarked the money for it. So, in the, you know, but in the end, when you go out and see how, what the actual ridership is right now, it's lower than any of these other estimates ever were. But there's no magic to it. That's the problem, is these are just estimates. It's really hard to do these estimates of cost or ridership because of unknowns. And then at the end, whether it's this or the aerial tram in Portland, then you have a lot of problems with potential overruns. Whereas incrementally expanding the chariots or smart bus service offers almost no risk.
So these two columns are not necessarily connected. One is an estimate of ridership and the other is an estimate of cost. They're not connected with each other. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Just wanted to make, I think okay. That was some of your question. Is that
right? That was it. I was wondering if this is obviously a estimate of cost and ridership per year, but then I'm seeing that the ridership is based on per day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Other questions? Thank you guys very much for coming.
Thanks.
Appreciate your testimony. And last, but absolutely not least, is Kelly Taylor. I think this is a nice way to finish up, to perhaps step back a little bit and get a sense of how this fits into larger issues around transportation and rail particularly. So, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Taylor. I'm the administrator of the Rail Division at the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I just wanted to respond again to some of the things I've heard and fill you in on some things that are going on. The 2007 legislature allocated some funds, $2 million, and directed us to do a rail assessment. And it's a lot of different pieces of both the freight and passenger system. And part of that we are just getting ready to do, and it has to do with looking at the extension of commuter rail from Wilsonville to Salem. And so the information that we're going to be doing at a high level for that would feed into and help this task force have that information to consider. We're going to be looking high level, and our stuff will be done by the end of this summer and then going into report. And this bill, of course, goes into effect in January, so it'll be there before the committee or the task force needs to start working on it. We already have looked in the first phase. We started this study, by the way, in February of last year, so we're well underway with looking at tunnels and bridges and all sorts of pieces of the puzzle that the assessment makes up. We have already looked at currently the passenger rail that you see between Eugene and Portland that goes on to Seattle and up to Vancouver, B.C., is running on the Union Pacific main line, sort of the rail equivalent to I-5, if you will. The other line that's sort of the equivalent to 99, Highway 99, is known as the Oregon Electric Line. It was actually created back in the early 1900s for passenger rail, for electric vehicles, passenger rail vehicles. So we've looked at what it will take if we were going to move off of the Union Pacific Line, because it's a very dense freight line. And two things will affect ridership. One is your frequency of service, how often you run. And two is whether or not you get there on time or anywhere close to on time. And with a very busy freight system, the passenger trains move off and wait for the freight systems to go by because they're longer trains and the passenger trains can fit in the little pull-offs better. So that affects ridership. So we've looked at, if we're going to have, according to statistics, 1 million more people in Oregon living between the Salem-Portland area in the next 25 to 30 years, and at the same time having freight go up 80% in their volume, then how do you move people around and what are your options? And if the freight's going to get busier on that Union Pacific line, we've looked at what it would take to move off of that and move the passenger and potential commuter onto the Oregon Electric line. So we've already been looking at a high level of what it would take, track upgrades, bridge changes, things like that, the infrastructure. That's your most expensive piece, frankly. And also the whole governance, because the thing about railroads, and you've heard people mention private industry, well, railroads are, for the most part, a private company operating their private business on their private property. That's their track and the ground underneath it. Now, the state does own a little bit of the right-of-way underneath some of that track, just the ground, but the tracks and the right to be there and operate belongs to that railroad company. And other than the federal agreement between Congress and the Class 1s back in 1971 when they wanted to get out of passenger rail service and they formed Amtrak. And so some of the Class 1s, Union Pacific, Burlington Northern, have to allow them on. The short line system does not have to allow them on, which is a lot of what the negotiation was with this piece of Wilsonville to Beaverton. So my point is, we can all want it, we can all dream about it, and we can cost it out. But in the end, if the railroad says no, it's no. And so the first thing you do is you go talk to the railroad before you spend any of the time doing anything else. And we have been talking to the railroad. They are absolutely willing to talk and stay engaged and be interested. But they want to make sure that in the end, if they were ever to agree to something, an extension or otherwise, no matter where you're at, that it doesn't harm their freight business, because that's what they're there for. And I don't blame them. I understand that. So I think that the first 15 miles is a good piece of the puzzle, and as Ms. Clark said, we need to let it run and see how it does. The freight system, the freight railroads are also looking at that, waiting to see how it does or doesn't impact their business, even with the infrastructure improvements. My point is, we have looked at the Oregon Electric line. We have looked at it for moving the long-distance trains over there. We are going to look now at commuter rail between Wilsonville and Salem. At a high level. And so we will have information, some ridership profiles, some cost to track, governance issues, et cetera. What is going on behind me?
Sorry.
I'm just like, totally like, what's going on? Is there like buddy ears?
It will become clear.
Okay. Sorry.
No, it's fine. Please.
I just thought, you know, I should do something different.
Nope, it's not.
Okay.
Nope, we apologize.
So we are looking at that, and that will help feed the conversation. We are also, by the way, looking at high level what it would take to take the long-distance trains between Eugene and Ashland at a very high level, not drilling down, but at just very high level. The thing that gets complex is there are 22 short lines in the state and two class ones, and so it isn't just one operator that you deal with. Just to get between Wilsonville and Salem isn't just Portland and Western. Yes, Portland and Western is the operator, but the state owns part of the right-of-way. That's not a big deal. But just north of the Volcano Stadium on I-5, the Volcano Baseball Stadium, becomes Burlington Northern, BNSF, and it goes down into Eugene. When you get to Eugene and you try to go south, you're now dealing with Central Oregon and Pacific as a short line, and some BN line and some UP line. So it's a patchwork. It's a quilt patchwork. And so you really... You can't just say, oh, well, we'll just work with this one or that one. It becomes more complicated. And frankly, you know, the railroads are reluctant for a couple of reasons to allow passenger rail onto their system. One is the impact of their business. The obvious, their trains conflicting with their trains, you know, passenger. Two, the liability of injury. If you have a derailment with freight, frankly, freight doesn't sue you, but people do. And so that's a reality, and people think railroads have deep pockets. And so they're very concerned about that from their liability standpoint. And the third thing that actually came up that I had not thought about before, when we were talking with Portland and Western about what it would take to move it off the Union Pacific line and on to the Oregon Electric line, and we said, well, gee, and there might be a stop on Woodburn, they kind of went, oh, well, you have to. One of the things we will be concerned about is where you place your stations, because it tends to change the land use around the station. And we have industrial customers that are important to our work base of what where we generate our revenue. And we have to be careful that the passenger stuff doesn't drive off the industrial and the businesses that we're driving on freight. And that was not a piece I had thought about. Land use changes because of what you're building in just a station. And so that is something we're also going to be looking at in the study, is some of that land use implication. So why I'm doing the study is to give you all information that we don't have about the system, its condition, how it's being used, how it's going to be used, its future, business trends, and what that dominoes out to in Oregon, whether it's a national business trend for the class ones that want to just take long trains and not pick up the short stuff anymore. Whether we build clusters, industrial clusters to deal with freight, I'm trying to gather the information so you all can make strategic decisions, use this as a blueprint for strategic decisions, especially when you're considering things like a Connect Oregon 3 or something like that, so that when we are picking projects, we have an idea of how the corridors work together, because no one mode does it all. They all work together, or they don't, which can be the problem. And I want to have information so if you're figuring that you're going to add this capacity on a rail line, you also understand the bridge and tunnel conditions, et cetera, so you know if there's a potential for a problem. because we don't have a lot of redundancy in the rail system. If you have a bridge go out or a tunnel go out, you can be completely shut off from service. A whole, and many of the communities served are rural communities. Not everyone's business or home is on the I-5, nor should it have to be, or do they want it to be. And so in order to keep those rural communities connected, you do need some rail service. And they do get a little antsy when you think you're going to take up their capacity that they have, even if you're willing to throw money at it and upgrade it with passenger. So I just want to say that I'm not trying to be the wet blanket. I'm just trying to put a dose of reality of what it can be like to try to negotiate this and why they get concerned. It isn't they wouldn't like their systems fixed up. They'd love their systems fixed up. But they have to make sure that their business is still there. Let's see, what else am I going to tell you? We did look at, should we look at Scappoose? Should we look at Forest Grove? Should we look at going to Hood River? What were the bits and pieces of string we could do commuter rail? And really, truly, the most logical spot to look at next is Wilsonville to Salem, just because of the simple riderships. But I want to point out, as my commission heard yesterday from a chief economist from HDR, there are a lot of reasons besides ridership to make decisions about what you do with rail or transit, et cetera, and or any of your decisions. It is livability. It is the pollution. It is the livability. It is fuel consumption, et cetera. There are a lot of reasons. And we are also taking that into consideration when we're looking at the rail assessment, what the return on investments are about sustainability versus just the dollar, because rail is a very capital-intensive business. It is one of the most capital-intensive businesses. They take 18 to 20% of their revenue to put it back into capital each year, much higher than manufacturing-type businesses and stuff. And so it's very difficult to do a cost-benefit, the hard, oh, I'm going to make this much savings out of this much. You have to look at other things that have value to them other than just the bottom line of what dollar savings you can make out of it. My point is we were looking at that. Now, there's one other piece I want to tell you that was kind of interesting when we looked at the Oregon Electric line. Now, I mentioned that the state owns a little bit of the right-of-way. There are about 2,400 miles of track in Oregon. About 54% of that, a little more than half, are owned or operated, I should say, by the short lines. Many of those lines are leased still from the Class 1s. So that's why you have two railroads to deal with. Portland and Western are leasing the right to be there and operate, but it's still owned by either Union Pacific or Berlin or BNSF. They're the two Class 1s in Oregon. So back in the 90s, late 90s, Burlington Northern was going to abandon the Astoria corridor between Portland and Astoria and part of the Oregon Electric line between Eugene and Salem up to Perkins Road, if anybody knows where Perkins Road is. But it's about a mile north or so of the Volcano Stadium. What they did was, since they didn't have a buyer for it because it was expensive, they asked the state if they would donate it to the state, would the state accept it? And there is liability to owning right-of-way, you know, because things happen on right-of-way again, and, you know, there's environmental issues, et cetera. But the state wanted to protect the corridor, and so we accepted it. So we own 170 miles of right-of-way, which is just the dirt beneath the track, and that's it. We don't own, there's two things down in the railroad, the dirt and the right to be there to operate. And Portland and Western owns the exclusive operating rights on that 170 miles that I'm talking about. So part of the time on coming down to Salem, you'll be dealing with us for the ground, but part of it you're dealing with Burlington Northern. So that's my point. Now, on the Oregon Electric line, what we looked at in the study was also electrification. Since it was an electric line to begin with, what would it ever take to make it go back to electric? Would it ever make sense? And we actually looked, you know, our highway project with the solar panels. I know you're probably familiar with that. We said, could you put solar panels on our right-of-way and generate enough electricity to run trains? And the answer came back, yeah, you could. You could actually generate, just on our amount of the right-of-way. Now, I'm not saying put panels on the railroad's right-of-way. I'm saying on our part of our stretch, if you were to put it on the panels there, you could generate enough electricity to run six trains a day, up and down. So is it expensive? Yes, it is. I just wanted to be able to answer the question because I've been asked, can we do something more sustainable and what would it look like? And there's a couple of ways to do electrification. There's the overhead catenary, and there's third rail in the actual rail you're going over. Now, when you do that, you need to have separated grades, et cetera, not have at-grade crossings because you don't want people touching the rails. You want to separate everything, and that becomes more expensive. But there's different ways to go at it. But we did, at a high level, Mr. Chair, look at solar energy and being able to run the trains that way. And if you were, again, you would probably use maybe a hybrid vehicle that can do both diesel and electric so that when you were on our part, you could have electric, and if you went off of it because you were still connecting onto some other part, there's a freight system to get to into the Union Station in Portland, and you had to go back onto the UP, and they didn't want the catenary lines, and so you had to switch over to diesel. There's ways to do there's actually hybrid train equipment out there. And I will tell you, it is sad that there's not very many train manufacturers around, and it takes you like 2 years to be on a list to get train equipment made. It's not like going down and finding a car lot somewhere where you can, there's lots of them around. There's just not train lots around where you can go kick a tire. So, and with that, I'll end.
Thank you very much. We have just a few minutes for questions. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. First of all, I apologize. Representative Glizio is a brilliant legislator, but he's sleep deprived, and it's hard to keep his attention on certain things, and he was kind of goofing around. Can you just say another word about your role and your with the state? I need to be brought up to speed. I'm sure I voted for that assessment, but I just need you to kind of give us just a little more history on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gillum, I run the rail division. We regulate railroads, both passenger and freight, and rail crossings, et cetera, come under my regulation. And it was a policy option package that had been part of the governor's budget, and Ways and Means agreed with it and wanted me to do a rail assessment. I think mostly because we are so dependent on a private system that we don't control, but we don't know much about it. And after watching different rail lines have difficulty, and yet with Connect Oregon, we are investing in those systems, et cetera, and having like the Coos Bay line be shut off because of some tunnels and nobody knowing about it and things, they wanted to get in front of it and say, could you do an assessment? Could you tell us what exists in our state and how we might get in front of some of the trends that could cut us off of service?
And you mentioned you'd started that February last year. Did you already say when that's going to be concluded?
It should be concluded, Mr. Chair, by the end of the summer, and they'll have a report put out.
Thank
yes.
you.
And it's a lot of pieces, but that's why. And it was backed by lottery bond dollars.
Two quick questions. Is the assessment including a line, it's a private short line, from Woodburn to Staten? I don't know the name of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, that would be the Willamette Valley Railroad. It is looking at their bridges and tunnels, and the bridges we're looking at is anything over 100 feet long, because those are the major bridges, or anything that's made out of steel, which is usually a big bridge, and all tunnels that are on the short lines. We concentrated on the short lines because between the two, short lines have infrastructure issues, whereas class ones have capacity issues.
And one last question, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I'm just curious about, in the event that, and you've certainly laid out the problems with going ahead, but if we did do the line from Wilsonville to Salem,
mm-hmm.
is the Kaiser Station Shopping Center now, as far as you know, set up for the zoning and all and so forth for it to be a stop, or would there be a lot more preparation for that? You know what I mean, the shopping mall?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, I certainly know Kaiser Station. I don't know the answer to that as far as zoning. That is one of the things we'll look at high level.
Okay.
Governance, who owns it. Also, we would look together putting a very high level looking at financing strategy, not drilling down, not trying to say whether to qualify for the federal transit. That is one of the big obstacles is the current regulations that Ms. Clark spoke to. Absolutely a barrier to try to get past to get funding because of their way they look at ridership, et cetera.
Representative Clegio.
Thank you. I'm sure Representative Gilliam will, after he describes the hydrogen hub to Representative Thatcher, have you done that yet? I'm not sure if he's done that yet. Wants to be a member of this task force. My question to you is, it sounds like the analysis you're doing, does it obviate the necessity for this task force?
And maybe if I could add on just another element to that same question, did these same issues exist when West began? In other words, do we need this task force as it relates to the assessment you're already undertaking?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lethio, I believe the issues probably existed. One of the things I didn't say that we're going to do is an interview of the parties that put together WES and work through it through the years for lessons learned, because we're going to use their hindsight for foresight. But many communities come to us and want to do commuter rail, and we are trying to put together a template for them. I think that my information is part of the puzzle, but by no means is the end of it. I think that the task force, when I talked to Representative Greenlink about this, I said, you know, actually this is the right timing for this task force, this session versus last session, just because we didn't have so much information and it would have been difficult for them to come back to you with anything. I mean, it takes some time and it takes some money to do this.
So we're hearing you say that this is
a good
logical
compliment.
Next step to follow
it
the
is
assessment
a very
that you're
logical
going to
next step. It okay. absolutely is. And I believe what they will do with this information, and I'm part of the task force should you pass this, is we will look through it and try to form for the next session what the next step is. Or everybody will have sticker shock and we'll all be done.
I just have one last question, unless anybody else does. Representative Foley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on your conversation, in regards to my interest in expanding the study or the task force to look at, going towards Eugene, just to look at that. But I think I'm hearing you say that this isn't the right time to consider that. I'm not sure whether I'm reading between the lines or not.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holby, I would say that would be maybe the next logical step, but not now. You have even Union Pacific and Burlington Northern and Portland and Western to deal with trying to go towards Eugene, deciding even when we looked at just moving off the UP line, Union Pacific for short, and moving it over to the Oregon Electric line, we're trying to figure out where we still have to touch the Union Pacific system to make it work. There's still a lot of negotiations just for the long-distance trains. And as Mr. Nussbaum mentioned, long distance on commuter trains may not be as comfortable as, just because of the equipment and people's needs on a long trip, restrooms, et cetera.
Follow up. So a long distance trip is 50 miles and 70 miles is a long distance, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, typically commuter rail is 50 miles or less, yes. I mean, generally, as a rule. Not that you couldn't make it. I mean, if we had, and people talk about high-speed rail, there are very levels, different levels of high-speed rail. We're talking 79 miles an hour, probably, maybe 110. And with 110, you have to do, again, more federal things, more infrastructure into it. So we're not quite to commuter rail from Eugene, but we could probably improve the system and its on-time performance to make it still available. And with frequencies, it may not be 16 trips in the morning like Wes is, but it may be enough that people could still get from Eugene to Portland in a reasonable amount of time and still use it to get to Portland for commuting.
I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the solar electric.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other places that have done that? What's the urgency around that? Is there any relationship with money that might be available to begin, or are you already exploring that in ways that are related to federal stimulus dollars or any of those kinds of timing issues?
Mr. Chair, we have only looked at it at a very high level. There are some parts in the country that have looked at it and California was one, a recent one. That's where we pulled some of our information on. I don't know exactly the status of that, and I do believe that back east there are some electric trains, yes.
Okay. And any relationship with any dollars that might be available to move that process forward?
Mr. Chair, we're probably a little soon on that. I've heard that there may be actually more than one stimulus package that ever happened. So, I don't know. I don't know that we would be ready to launch right now.
Okay. Very good.
I'm sure we're not.
Representative Gilley?
I just want to be sure, I don't know if we covered this, could you comment on the possibility of going to Eugene?
Hydrogen hubs.
Tricked out RVs.
Oh, you're good to put up with this, sorry.
There aren't any other questions. I'm mindful of the time, and I know there's another committee here. One last note, just as we conclude, for the record, to note that we did receive some written testimony on House Bill 2408 from Diana Dickey. You've all got that, so I would commend that to your attention. And if there aren't any other comments for the good of the order, we will adjourn the committee. Thank you very much.